This is Dev Propulsion Labs, a podcast about building successful developer tools hosted by Evil Martians. I'm Arina, the CEO at Evil Martians and your host today. I'm here in place of your favorite host, Victoria, who's hopefully taking a break from everything tech and enjoying her maternity leave as we're all expecting a new baby Martian quite soon. And today, I'm excited to have Alice Chen on the show, a co-founder and CTO at startup Open Context. With over 20 years of experience under her belt, Alice has shined in roles that span continuous integration, continuous delivery, multi-cloud environments in tech giants like HP and Informatica, while also actively contributing to open source. With Open Context, she's bringing to light the intricate relationships between teams, projects, and code to ensure efficient collaboration within an organization. Join us as we delve into Alice's journey of innovation, her experience and vision to help us inform our own journeys building developer tools startups. Alice, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks. So happy to have you here. And thank you for supporting me in this new role. So tell us about Open Context and the idea behind it.
So Open Context, it was built to solve problems with answering questions, really, right? It was built to map a company's people to their tech stack, because like so many of these questions that I discovered while working in the enterprise, like, could be answered easily if you had this map in hand, because it's like, think of it as metadata, right? What really is the goal is, like, instead of taking, say, a day, 2 days to find an answer that could be easily answered by somebody, say, overseas or whatever, because you don't know the exact person you want to talk to, this tool is designed to help you so you can get to the right person as quickly as possible and then just ask them the question versus doing the, hey, y'all, you know, in Slack, or hey, everybody, you know, on this D list, and maybe somebody might answer you because you're not sure because you didn't specify who you wanted an answer from, right? So, like, this is a very common problem as organizations get bigger.
Yeah, I definitely can see this problem. Even in our organization, we just have 50 people, but sometimes you can feel that as, like you said, you don't want to mention and seek answer from everyone because it's just too expensive, if you think about it, for the organization to spend, for everyone to spend time solving a question or even paying attention to a question. But you want something like a map where you can immediately see who has context on a certain project or code or service. So that you can address those maybe problem, maybe urgent problems in an efficient manner.
Yeah. I mean, really, the goal is as little interruption for your team as possible, right? Like, because we all know, like, even like a 2 minute like walk by, ask somebody this quick question, it takes them out of the context of whatever they were doing. And there's studies that show that it takes, what, 20 minutes? Like, 10, 20 minutes on a good day, on a quick context switch, like that's how long it takes to get back into doing things, especially if it's like, you know, coding and stuff like that, which is very like concentration, like you need a lot of concentration focus, right, to do it. It's like, well, I just lost that thought. I just lost that algorithm in my head. Bye. All right. How long is it going to take me to figure this one out again?
Yeah, so deep work, right? I love the idea of paying attention and really valuing the idea of deep work and having teams, you know, the opportunity to focus on their work without continuous interruptions. Like you said, it takes much more time than just answering one question to switch from context and back into it. Totally a super interesting area. I wonder how you guys are approaching it. like approaching the solution? Because, I mean, you also don't want to bug too many people with keeping things in writing, keeping everything in writing, and I don't know, using too many tools in parallel so that you keep track of everything. So what's your approach, I think, to solving this problem?
So our approach is a couple of things. Like mostly we have a focus on trying to integrate with as many existing tools as possible, as easily as possible, right? Like we don't want to pull the developer out of their workflow just to write a thing for us if we don't have to. So that comes to the second point, which is like, we're very focused on automation, if at all possible. If we can auto-discover that relationship, we will. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of things we can't auto-discover because it's based on the organizational structure. But what we're really trying to do is minimize the amount of writing, like configs or whatever, that a developer has to do to keep track of all this. Because you and I know, they write it today, it's out of date in less than a month. Like, that's usually how these things work, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And then it's just legacy, whatever. And
nobody wants to maintain that, right? Yeah. So if I can figure it out, or if the tool can figure this out on its own to some degree because there's already a lot of metadata, right? That's already sitting mm-hmm. in all the tools that we use and all this stuff. Exactly. It's just mm-hmm. not being, how we call it? It's not being aggregated quite properly is mm-hmm. what I think. It's actually not being aggregated at all, if you think about it.
Yeah.
People try, but I mean, really, like big, large enterprises, they have many of these projects to go and try to mm-hmm. aggregate these things, but it's hard to keep track of. It's so hard. Yeah. There's so many different tools and more coming every single day. You know, we're in tech. So
absolutely, yeah.
Every day, new tool.
that's so true. And that's what I really like about your startup, that you guys are integrating with so many tools and not just expecting people to use your tool in like vacuum in addition to everything else, on top of everything else. It's just, like you said, unrealistic. But if you can deliver some value sort of automatically, people are, I think, more have better incentives to then maybe contribute some of their time kind of improving what's already there. Yeah. And I also remember something you said before when we chatted on after this kind of breakfast we had. That mm-hmm. sometimes you can discover something that the organization didn't know was there. So, for example, they thought they're not using some technology service or tool, but apparently they are. And that's something interesting, right?
Yeah. It's really interesting because as you think about it, like, especially enterprises and like larger companies, they don't have one kind of tech stack usually. Mm-hmm. I mean, they try, but they don't. I mean, quite mm-hmm. honestly, because they're always in the middle of migrating or doing something this nature. They aren't all microservices. Never going to happen. Like, it's just not going to happen. Like, they're a combination of monoliths and microservices. Like that's just mm-hmm. the way it is, because it's not efficient to migrate existing working code that's in a monolith in production to microservices. It's not always let's just say I've seen it where it's like it was not a good idea to do that in the first place.
Right? Yeah, and then
you've actually created more work for your own teams.
Yeah,
and so because of this, you know, this very messy code structure, messy stuff, your repositories, I say your code repository, first of all, you might have multiples of them, which I hope you don't, but some people do. I meaning like multiple like Git like providers, like I have
oh
seen
my
this
God,
happen before,
seriously?
Too.
No,
yes,
I didn't think about it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like enterprises can have all kinds of interesting combinations. Let me just tell you mm-hmm. that. But mm-hmm. if you, let's just say everybody's like, say, on GitHub or something, even with that, because enterprises are so big and there's so much code, there's mm-hmm. so many repositories. Think of how much time it would take for someone that has enough system knowledge about all the how the different apps work together and all this other stuff yep. to be able to hand create a map and architecture yep. of these things. You and I know architecture is hard. We get updated like as time progresses. Like it's just one of those things because it's difficult to. Because in some cases it's changing too quickly.
That's so cool to think about. Yeah, that's amazing. I think idea that if you work in a smaller organization, a smaller product, you will think, okay, we have this tech stack, and now we switch to something else. And this was a hell of migration. It took us a year, but we did it, right? And yes. you'd think, oh, the whole year we were in the middle of this migration, and it was painful and whatever. But then you have those bigger organizations, and like you, what you're saying is essentially, they are always in this state of moving off of something into something. Some parts are still like sort of forever stuck in the old stack just because, yeah, like you say, rewriting and redoing all of that work is just meaningless and it's just too expensive. It's never prioritized. It's never in the center of sort of the focus of the organization, right? To kind of complete everything, to make sure everything is like beautiful, clean in one place and all of that. Yeah.
They simply can't, right? Like mm-hmm. it takes too much engineering power, too much of everybody's time to be able to do all of this. And as you said, the payoff is not necessarily great or immediate. Yep. And we yep. all know people want more immediate payouts these days.
Yeah. And I mean, what they end up getting is maybe something else sometimes. But yeah, that's, I mean, the reason why I'm asking you so thoroughly about that is this. First of all, I've never worked in a big tech myself, but as other people building products for engineers, in the end of the day, I want to sort of be able to sell those products to those big organizations, right? And this is where yeah. I really enjoy getting your insight on that because it's so unique, so valuable for me to understand a bit more what the organization might look like, you know, from the inside. Because my kind of ideas of how the organizations work would come from my own experience, and this is like smaller organizations, so they did have none of those problems. Yeah. So yeah, so thank you, thanks for. So that's important. I think it's going to be important for our listeners also building enterprise software, right? And it can be different things. Sometimes mm-hmm. you start with like maybe middle size organizations, but you're considering enterprises as your clients. So you need to understand what your clients, like customers, might look like. What else could you share that would be useful, that you find useful when building for enterprises, when building for those organizations?
I think an important thing to understand is not everybody you talk to in an enterprise has any buying power or has any decision-making mm-hmm. power, right? So mm-hmm. like you oftentimes to actually sell to the enterprise, you need to get up to VP level, whatever. Sometimes if the product, the amount like you're asking them to pay for it comes like below a certain threshold, you mm-hmm. might be able to get a director to pay for it. Mm-hmm. Maybe. Mm-hmm. Like this is a very big maybe. And that's kind of one of the biggest things that is very different from a small company versus like a really big company, right? Like it's easy for me to say right now in Open Context, I want this tool, and or if my developers say I want this tool and this is going to be super useful, to just let them buy it. Because mm-hmm. there's not other things to consider, right? Like there's not a lot of these other like, well, now, like, is it secure enough? Is it, you know, like yep. there's a lot of just things that mm-hmm. that enterprises like care about, because like a lot of them are highly regulated, right? goodness if you're going to sell to them, but they also will pay you probably the most money because mm-hmm. they're highly regulated. If you can get in, right, mm-hmm. like if you can get in and they like it, like, well, that's actually a pretty good client. Although, like, if you build strictly for their needs, then it might become a little bit too specific. Your product might become a bit actually too specific for that yeah. client. So you have to be careful about that too, right? There's just a lot more regulations you have to go through. Mm-hmm. And if you have like a SaaS product, oh, this one's even more interesting. If you have a SaaS product, then you are actually going to have to worry about security far sooner than you probably would like. Because generally, in order to sell into the enterprise with a SaaS product, mm-hmm. you need to be at least on your way to SOC 2 certification.
Yeah, and that's kind of nightmare.
And that's just expensive. Yeah, it's very expensive. Yeah. It's an expensive proposition. And mm-hmm. if you have a really small team, it's next to impossible to do. Mm-hmm. Right, because it's separation of duties. Like three people, how are you going to separate enough duties to qualify, so to speak? You know what I mean?
Yep. That's definitely a challenge. I think my experience with that, I never sold to anything to like a really big organization, other than eBay. But that was interesting, though. By the way. We didn't work with the sort of core eBay, but we could work with uh-huh. their sort of additional branches that behaved more like startups than the core organization. That was...
Yes.
But other than that, SOC 2, I mean, yeah, startups, maybe if you are definitely beyond Series A, right? Somewhere there you can approach... SOC 2, but if you are just starting, I agree. I mean, is it possible at all? It's expensive.
I think it's mm-hmm. possible starting mm-hmm. if you can get your VCs and investors to agree mm-hmm. with you yeah. that this is very important mm-hmm. and that so that way you can hire like a big enough engineering team to yeah. both do that and then to worry about SOC 2 and security. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, I would say in general, no. Like if you're trying mm-hmm. to bootstrap the company or yeah. if you're just like, if you don't have a lot of money, meaning in the double digits, like million type of a yep. thing, yep. I don't really think it's possible because it's too complex. There's too many things you have to worry about. And like I'm wearing multiple hats. This is the other problem. How can you have a separation of duties if you're wearing like four different hats? Like it's next to impossible, in my opinion.
Yep.
Right? And so it just makes it, to me, it feels like if you try to do it early, you're going to be running in circles. Because you can't do this because of this, and you can't do that because of that. Or if you're going to do that, then it's going to cost you like this X amount of like, tons of dollars to do it. And is it worth it at that stage, so, right? Like that's what you have to kind of ask yourself.
So what would you recommend then? So measure we have, by the way, and you guys are probably in a similar situation, also an early stage startup with a small team targeting, let's say, larger organizations, right? Maybe not exactly, you don't want to go off to Google right away, probably. but HBO on the other hand.
they're pretty big, even though they split. No.
Yep. I'm just kidding, thinking about your, I don't know, maybe sometimes your the kind of past connections can help, but I'm not exactly sure. So how do you guys approach that?
Different companies require you to be further along or less along in this particular mm-hmm. security path than others, mm-hmm. right? Like some, like say, if you were going to sell to a financial fintech company, oh my goodness, they're probably definitely going to ask for, you know, SOC 2, like immediately before you even start, right?
Before they even shake hands.
Yes. True. Yes. Because they're highly regulated. However, like there are some enterprises that they're a lot more forgiving. It's really, this is a lot of negotiation. Some of them, it's more like, you just have to ask. Like, so or if they don't bring it up, like, you just, okay. but really, like, it's more of a negotiation thing of, like, do they actually need SOC 2, or is it they just want you to follow some security best practices? Because that's a different question, right? Like, if they just want to make sure, like, you're not handling data, like, terribly, you're like, you know, like, you have at least some, like, reasonable practices and whatnot, mm-hmm. then it can be delayed a bit, so to speak.
Yep.
Right? You can go more along the lines of SOC 2 is on our roadmap, but we're not there yet.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
However, if it's the other end, and it's like, no, we have to have, well, okay, then that's a different conversation altogether. The other thing is, if your product is capable of being built in like a container or something of this nature, mm-hmm. like, you could think of giving them instructions on, you can try to sell self-hosting.
Self-hosting, yeah.
A self-hosted mm-hmm. version. But then now you have to consider the fact that it might cost you a lot of people time on your side. Because now you need someone to do post-sales to go help them set it up and all this other stuff. I mean, depending on instructions, obviously. If it's very simple or theoretically very simple, then maybe you don't need it as much. But it's something you would have to consider, right? Because there's a trade-off. If you host it, you have full control of the environment. If they host it, who knows what kind of weird thing they're going to pop up with. And they will. I guarantee you they will pop up with something you didn't even buy. You didn't plan. Because you're like, who would ever do something like this? And, well, this is an enterprise. And
honestly, this is exactly my experience with the selling on-premise Anycable to organizations. So they, first of all, like what you said, that they might ask for SOC 2, but then they kind of back off. I don't know. I had this experience. I just said, well, no, we don't have that. And then a month later, the company returns and says, oh, we're ready. I mean, sometimes it's just that. Sometimes, like you said, it's some negotiations, some figuring out what is the minimal sort of requirement, right? And not the standard requirement, right? So kind of, exactly. And I love that you're calling this post-sales, right? The idea that they purchase a license and then they really often, very often need help deploying, setting that up, or maybe sort of linking it with their monitoring tools, with their ecosystem of tools that they have. If I'm being like fully open, for Evil Machines is just a source of some of our business, so that's why we kind of treat it as a good thing. But I definitely, as a small startup without this kind of consulting company next to you, this is something to worry about, because it does require a lot of attention, that's for sure. The good thing is, I think if I were a small startup without a consulting company, I would maybe sometimes charge organizations for consulting, but just sort of charge for that time.
You should. I think that's one of the things I learned, like, at Armory as a solutions architect. So I wasn't post-sale. It is definitely better to charge them and to give... Okay, everybody wants to get the most money out of whatever contract they have with you, right? This is just the natural way of things, right?
Yep.
But if your contract is too general, too broad, then you eventually start doing things that go out of scope, because it's things that they want to integrate with your product or whatever, because it's easier for them or for whatever reason, but it's going to be a one-off thing for you. Unless, like, there's a mutual benefit, like, then you start having all these one-off things that your post-sales people are doing, and now they don't actually have the time to continue working with the other existing clients. Your post-sales people only have so much bandwidth, and they can only help so many people to really sell, I think. Like, to actually, like, really sell, you would need a more specific demo, more cater towards that company, which means in turn, you and the sales team is going to have to spend more time researching the company, figuring out what other things they integrate with, and try to make sure, like, when you're doing the sales demo and stuff like that, that it's almost fully catered to them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, I think I can imagine. It's still hard for me to imagine that I could understand the company from just the public resources.
You can. This is why it's like a long back and forth. So that's the other thing to keep in mind about enterprise sales, right? Enterprise sales is generally a lot of negotiation, a lot of back and forth, and it has a very, very long tail. Like 6 months, if you can actually close a deal in 6 months, you're doing awesome. Like really, like in general. So
this is mind-blowing.
That's a thing. Yeah, but this is very different from like a startup or a small company, right? Because as I said, you have to get to the right buyer. And on top of it, you have to convince that buyer plus everybody, not whatever part of the organization that reports them that wants this tool, they have to all agree, right? Yep. And then after they agree, now you have to get security to buy off on this, which is another entire process on itself.
Yep.
And then procurement has to buy off on this, which is, again, another entire new process on itself. So it's like there's a lot of, how would I call it? Thank God I'm not a salesperson, but there's a lot of like chasing after people and making sure like we all agree to X, Y, and Z and whatnot. I do say, I think that's pretty much what the salespeople end up doing for the majority of the time. Like when you start talking about enterprise sales, because now it's the relationship you have with the company and the people there.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what makes the sale. In the end.
Yep. In the end, you end up, like you said, having a relationship on many levels between your organizations. And this is when you make the sale. And you then, like, hopefully, when you have this organization as your client, they will remain your client for some time because... I mean, they went through this whole process and now they maybe become your like real partner or something like that. What do you think?
Have you ever heard of the strategy land and expand for sales?
Land and expand. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Right. So for enterprises, that is the strategy, literally. So you find the smallest part of the organization with all the right components and people, right, that will use your product and you sell into them first. Then what you want to do, you don't want to just keep them, you want to expand them, right? So now what you want is like your sales post. This is why post sales is important, right? Because if they have a good experience with you and whatnot, then it's much more easy to convince them to expand to another part of the organization and continue to use your product. And this is, of course, assuming your product needs a lot of post-sales handling, but even for those that don't, like good support handling is, I think, critical, because if your initial customer in that company gets irritated enough, you're for sure not expanding. Like you're good if they keep the contract and don't disappear on you, right? Like, so that's some of the other things. Like sometimes them signing a contract and not doing anything with the product is probably not a good sign.
Yeah, totally.
Right?
Totally.
You might think it is because they're not bothering you. But is it really?
Gotcha.
Because that means they're not using the product to be able to run into corner cases or whatever, whatever. So if your support case is zero, either you have a very, very good product and it has absolutely zero bugs, or they're not interacting much with it, or they're only using the simple use case. But now that's also a good point for either pre-sales or post-sales to go in and talk to them some more and see if you can get them to expand their use case. Because the more the product they can use, right?
Beautiful.
The more likely they will stay.
Absolutely. Yep. So you got to make sure that you not only sell to the organization, but that the organization gets value from the product, and from that you can then build it further. Absolutely. I love this idea that selling to organization is not enough. It's just the beginning. In a startup, you can never feel completely safe and secure and all of that. It's always risk. It's always a lot of uncertainty. But on the other side of that is hope and optimism. And they think hope and optimism is something that is so unique to founders of startups, because the reason you start is that you have this optimism and hope. So I want to ask you, what are your sources of optimism? Why can you be optimistic about your product, this whole industry, maybe the world, and what makes you look into the future with hope?
Okay, that's
that's a lot.
But okay, I'll try to answer that. Well, so I do hope that our product will actually make everybody's lives easier. That was that's kind of one of the core principles of why we or why I decided to create this particular product, right? Yep. Because it was painful for me to see, you know, to see people wasting time, effort, and energy to get an answer to a thing that shouldn't have been so difficult to answer, right? So if my product, if any other product, tech product out there, there's a whole bunch, can reduce like this toil that all these engineers have in their day-to-day life, I'm all for it. Like that's really the ultimate goal, is to make it so you're not constantly fighting with your, with whatever setup you have in your organization. Because most people, if you think about it, most people are probably overwhelmed already, right? Mm-hmm. Because like we've been having lots of layoffs, we've been having all these things, the world is all over the place right now.
Yep.
And so there's already too many things in people's brains.
Yep.
Like, is it like, if you can take even a little bit of that off, a little bit of that, like, oh my God, like I need to go find this thing now. And you know what, if you can just even reduce that by a little bit, that gives them more time. Maybe hopefully that gives them like a chance to calm down. It gives them a chance to be more rational and do things more rationally versus being kind of always in a firefighter mode. Right?
Exactly.
Used to work in operations. I hate being constantly in firefighter mode. Like that's like you, if you don't have breaks from doing that, like and big enough break, your brain's like in chaos all the time. All the time. Everything becomes slower too because you're constantly in fight and flight mode. Like you're not gonna get a lot done, right? And so like that's one of the things I hope like our product could help with. But I also hope like there's with more new tech, with maybe even these LLMs and stuff like that, right? Like it can help with that. Apply the right way, obviously. I always have to caveat it with apply the right way, because there are wrong ways to apply these things, but I hope.
Yep.
You know, with these new technologies applied the right way and whatnot, like everybody's life can be easier. Like I wouldn't mind a tech companion, right? But you know, I don't want to use it for all things.
it's a great way to put it. So taking those fight and flight situations from our let's say from our work at least, and turning them into productive, efficient processes where we can all work together productively. And even if it means, like you said, eliminating some time, but also eliminating the situation where you feel the urge to run around in circles and feel the panic. If you're eliminating this and turning it into a predictable process, it means everything. It really means everything because it is a great opportunity in tech. I 100% agree with you on that, to take the situations where we behave irrationally because we're under certain emotions, because the situation requires us to be in those emotions because it's something unpredictable, whatever, and we cannot like solve it immediately. And turning them into productive processes, into collaboration that is feels natural for both sides. This is the goal. I love this idea so much. Thank you. Thank you for this.
Thanks for catching yet another episode of Dev Propulsion Labs, brought to you by Evil Martians. We transform early-stage startups into unicorns, build developer tools, and create open-source products. We'd be thrilled to chat with you about your startup. Visit evilmartians.com/devtools to make it happen. See you in the next episode.